Chapter 5. What's Next? Mutual Musings on the Afterlife. One day, I went to see an Orthodox Jewish lady named Miriam, who at this stage in her life felt she could accept a visit from a religious outlier like a female rabbi. Orthodox Jews do not believe women should be ordained. Seated in a heavy chair by her bed with a view of the Hudson River from her window, she set aside a magazine to talk with me. Most of her kosher lunch was on the tray attached to the front of her chair. The food had grown cold and odorless and lay mostly uneaten, even though it was well past lunchtime. Because I was a rabbi, I suppose, she dispensed with all the small talk one normally feels obligated to preface deeper matters with, especially the first time one meets anyone new. She joined her hands together, interlocking the fingers, and affirmed she was completely sure that after death, she would be in existence somewhere, somehow. She was seemingly looking forward to it and very curious as one might be about what might be in store for one after some major change, such as a graduation or marriage. She wondered aloud, "What's next?" I half-jokingly replied, "Although our religion says there is an afterlife, it is a little skimpy on the details." Miriam gave me a stern look, but then could not resist a smile. I was in awe of her certainty, and on my way back home, the colors of the traffic lights had never looked so vivid to me before, nor the hushed sound of the rain gaining ground over the dry spots on the pavement. The mystery of death is somehow tied to the mystery of all forms of existence, of chaos and order, of energy and matter, of objects and living things, of sweet and sour, of elation and dejection, of stillness and motion. I also experienced a similar intensification of life when I had a scare about my father one day in 2011. He was 90, and I got a phone call from my brother that Dad suddenly had to go to the hospital. I had to wait until the next morning to learn that he was fine and was sent home. But the evening before, as I gazed at the plants and fat pens and snack containers parading down one side of the kitchen table, each object looked more intensely present, as if the thought of death was a foil for material things to more insistently signal me their existence. Perhaps there's a relationship between life and death, not a negation of one by the other. Could it be that both are parts of something even bigger? Do they fit together, like two sides of a coin? If so, then we will not end up like a light bulb gone bad. To put it another way, we will not simply cease existing, but continue in some fashion beyond our comprehension. What I know for sure is that we will go to any lengths to deny that death finishes the job. Sometimes, on the way to a funeral, I will be lazy about dealing with directions and just ride along in the hearse with the director. Directors tell me plenty of stories about strange behaviors and incidents at funerals. Like me, they also get their share of bemused reactions upon answering the question, "And what do you do for a living?" One director told me during our ride that the most frequent second question he gets after answering the first one is, "Once in the casket and in the ground, do bodies move around?" Perhaps people ask this not just to back off from death's finality, but to express how inconceivable it is, or at least to put off giving the angel of death the last word. At least metaphorically, people like to speak of the dead as carrying on the same relationships in the next world as they did in this one. One time I officiated at an unveiling with rather unusual circumstances. An unveiling is a Jewish ceremony performed at the graveside approximately 1 year after the death to mark the closure of the most intense stages of grief. Sheldon, who had gotten my name from the funeral home's clergy referral list, had lost both his father and his brother within about 6 months of each other. On top of that, Sheldon told me on the morning of the unveiling itself that his uncle had died a few days earlier and that he and his family would be attending the funeral that very same day in the afternoon. Some of the family had come from 1,000 miles away, and so we indulged in some naughty two-for-one jokes about fate having saved them the fare of a second plane trip. Sheldon gestured to his brother's and father's graves and pointed out that his mother's grave was in between her spouse's and her son's. Sheldon said, "Good thing Mom's grave lies there between 'em.
My father and brother never quite got along, and she did what she could to keep the peace. And so there she is, where she'll keep the peace between 'em still.
As I am writing, an encounter crosses my mind that inexplicably calmed down my fears that there might be no afterlife after all. That it was just wishful thinking. I had been a graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin and was flying home during a holiday break. Being a dyed-in-the-wool academic, I got into a philosophical discussion with an elderly gent across the aisle about the meaning of life and other weighty matters. At some point, I must have expressed my fears about plane crashes or death because he said, "No matter what, even if we crash, we will be all right in some cosmic sense." Somehow I felt calm and secure after he said that. Perhaps his being older gave me confidence that I would find the inner peace he had managed to acquire. Perhaps his pervasive calm, in stark contrast to my anxious and unpredictable parents, gave me an inkling of what it was like to be taken by the hand, even at the edges of the valley of death, where I was to fear no evil. At the University of Texas itself, there was a second wise soul about the same age who fascinated my friends and me. He was an intellectual who felt his mission was to get into discussions with students to challenge their assumptions. One could often find him in the Texas Union, a building filled with eateries and other places for students to hang out. He was definitely non-threatening, except to those who wanted to remain ensconced in their narrow comfort zones. He was kindly, spiritual, sagacious, and, of course, bearded. He often stationed himself at a table in the Cactus Cafe to catch the eye of someone to commune with. When we joined him, his mantra was, "Everything about each moment is so rich and so astonishing." Although he offered no proof of an afterlife, his concentrated focus on the present shunted my concerns away from the afterlife and redirected them to the everlastingness of now. William Blake had his own version of this wisdom. To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. Nevertheless, as attractive as the present is, we are always game for any arguments in favor of the more sought-after prize, especially when we're attending a funeral. Life beyond the grave. Just as a magnifying glass intensifies the sun's heat on any object beneath it, a funeral forces us into a highly concentrated examination of our mortality and its possible sequel. As we hear eulogies, we hope they will reinforce our belief that there is a sequel to contemplate in the first place. In 2011, when heaps and heaps of snow were dumped on the ground in the Northeast, I was asked to do a funeral for a 61-year-old man who died of a heart attack while shoveling snow the day before. One of the speakers got up to tell the following Jewish parable. There were twins in the womb, and one was an optimist and one was a pessimist. The optimist said, "You know, when we get out, we're going to have a new and happy life." But the pessimist said, "Nah, who are you kidding? This is it. We die when we leave here." The optimist was born first, very happy indeed, but he screamed when he got slapped by the doctor. The pessimist could hear him scream, and so he says, "See that? Wasn't I right? He was killed." The speaker then said he was not sure how this folktale connected with the occasion. I think it was his wish to be more certain that going from shoveling of snow to being shoveled under dirt was not going to be the end of his loved one's story. After working for hospice almost 7 years, I have heard many patients express their beliefs of what may happen in the afterlife. Usually, I hear very traditional ones, such as ending up in heaven or hell. But once in a while, I will hear something out of the ordinary that reshapes my own beliefs. Eileen, a 95-year-old elder sister of the deceased, was mulling over this subject with me and said, taking my hand,
"I think what happens is different for everybody. We're all different."
Then I realized something I never thought through before. Instead of thinking there are only two overall choices, such as heaven versus hell, or existence versus oblivion, maybe we have a multitude of available destinations, or even designer passageways for each person. Maybe some of us will end up with predeceased family members. Maybe some of us will merge with the energy of the cosmos. A handy plan B for those who do not yearn to be reunited with their dysfunctional parents. And maybe some of us will resurface in some regrouping of molecules into a new consciousness, or be reformulated whole in another dimension or universe.
In a eulogy I gave at another funeral about the deceased's wonderful marriage, I described a hoped-for afterlife for the couple in this way. Zelda and Joseph are now both together in a different place. Perhaps this place is a fifth dimension, or another world, or as the Jewish tradition puts it, the world to come. However it is characterized, it is a place constructed out of the love that flowed between them. Spirit, as we continue to walk this earth, spanning a bridge between this world and the next. I got the idea for a eulogy like that in the first place because in 2006, I myself had a close brush with death, which made me feel like what I was brushing up against was another dimension. As I was heading home from Princeton, New Jersey to Kearney, I collided with a car ahead of me on Route 1 North. A thin lone flame appeared under the hood of my Toyota Camry as the hood burst open upon contact. But I knew from my half hour's worth of disaster training that I had to flee from the car without even pausing to pick up my belongings. It took less than a minute for the fire to spread all over the vehicle. As I stood shivering on a prematurely cold day on the side of the road, after calling 911, I had the sensation that something from the world to come, as Jews refer to the afterlife, was seeping out into this life, and that I was fleeing from that as well. It felt alien, and I knew that I did not want to have anything to do with it at that point in my life, so I did not linger to peer over the edge, so to speak. That experience has influenced me to believe that death is an interface between two ways of being, one in our current consciousness and one in some other consciousness. This sensation of a thin barrier between life and death dates all the way back to my earliest memory of a close brush with death when I was about 11 years old. Several workermen had come to our house to remove worn-out wall-to-wall carpets and install spanking new ones. I remember my brother and I having to sleep in the living room overnight while all the furniture was in disarray. The workers had propped a round marble tabletop against a chair quite near the spot on the floor I had unwittingly selected to sleep. The top was precariously resting against the chair, and boom! As my brother later put it, a very local gust of wind blew your hair around as it fell down a couple of inches or so from your head. That wake-up call jolted me into considering my mortality. The next morning, I went to my day calendar, the kind with those tear-off sheets where the digits of the date itself gobble up most of the sheet in the thickest black and where the name of the month meekly sits toward the bottom. Sitting at my white vanity desk and looking at our lilac trees in the backyard through my bedroom window, I crammed a few lines on the back of the day's sheet about my first brush with death. Strangely enough, I was not frightened. I was caught up in the mystery of how close at hand death could be. It was only years and years later that I released my arrested fear from its deep freeze. I still puzzle over why I was not frightened at the time. It is curious that Jewish mystics dwell on the idea of a thin boundary between life and death. They say these two states are more commingled and more alike than we think, and that both are part of something bigger. Jewish mystics also believe that when we die, we go back in reverse through the same steps that brought us into being. They believe that as we become alive, we move from a very abstract spiritual essence of the divine to levels that are more and more physical, until we become material things. Then as we die, we climb back through progressively more and more spiritual layers of the divine until reaching pure energy. This top level, they say, is an outpouring of infinite compassion. And so to me, all of this convoluted abstraction amounts to the belief that when we die, we complete our round trip back home to God. This calm reaction to being in hailing distance of death continued when I was a student at Oberlin College in the 70s. I was very trusting in whatever fate had in store, even during a medical emergency that could have sent me on a very early trip to my spiritual home. I was in my sophomore year when one day I felt severe pain in my abdomen. In no time, I found myself on an ambulance to Allen Memorial Hospital. Despite the nonstop pain, I distracted myself by speaking with the Hispanic personnel in Spanish. That was the first time my minor in Spanish became very handy. Much later, I would speak Spanish to some of my Latino patients and translate for the nurses and social workers. The diagnosis was a large ovarian cyst which required immediate surgery. My parents drove in from Erie, Pennsylvania, and my brother flew in from New York City for the occasion. At the time, the family scrambling to see me did not sound the alarm in my mind of how serious the surgery must have been for them to drop everything and be at my bedside. In fact, I felt very calm being surrounded by family and friends. Even my Spanish language professor, Dr. Harriet Turner, stopped by, baffled by my buoyant painkiller-induced mood as I laughingly recounted practicing Spanish in the ambulance. As I awaited the surgery, I remember flash-forwarding to a possible scenario of being sent off by my visitors if the surgery proved fatal. I think the lesson here is that before our actual time comes, we will not know whether we will be afraid or calm or angry or indifferent. On top of that, I do not think we will be able to relate to the frame of mind we will be until it happens. To think we can understand this ahead of time would be like asking a child to relate to the mind of an adolescent, or pressing an adolescent to imagine how middle-aged adults view the world. After finishing up my undergraduate studies at Oberlin College and getting a PhD in linguistics at the University of Texas at Austin, I became an assistant professor of Spanish at Denison University in 1985. Before that point, nothing particularly challenged my belief in the afterlife. In fact, as I said, that mysterious gentleman in the airplane, like an angel in disguise, quieted my fears. But one day, while I was having an early lunch in the Denison cafeteria on January 28th, to make sure I would watch the Challenger mission, I, of course, saw the explosion, and then the errant path of the rocket. My first thought was that a tremendous number of high school students were viewing it, too, because the high school teacher, Sharon Krista McAuliffe, was on board. Worst of all, her own students must have been watching. After the horror of all that subsided enough for me to think further, I asked myself how the spirits of the astronauts could have endured the total annihilation of their bodies. Somehow, in a normal death, when a body slowly decomposes, it had seemed to me that the soul would escape to its destination as soon as the last breath was drawn. That was why the Challenger incident was the first event that threw my beliefs about life after death into so much disarray. So sometimes I think there may be no consciousness of any kind after death, but rather a dissipation of ourselves into the general fabric of the cosmos. Science says that matter and energy may be interchangeable, so maybe death is like the wormhole that whizzes us from matter to a more energy-like state. I realize it is cold comfort for us to picture our remains reborn into a context far removed from anything we know, or that our identity as distinct beings just up and disintegrates into a whirligig of energy particles rather than arriving intact on our trip back to God. This is not a satisfying view of the afterlife in any meaningful sense of the word. It is scarcely better than being like a hapless fish dangling on a line that will be yanked into oblivion. So on I go, continuing to vacillate between my fear that there is no afterlife to firmly believing in some new home for my inner core of being. What I know for sure is that even after all these years of occasionally being with persons within minutes or hours of their deaths, I still feel a sense of mystery in their presence. When their eyes are open or half open, I most definitely do not get the impression that they're staring into nothingness. Often, they look like they're peering into and preparing for some other kind of reality beyond our ken. I sense the sacredness of transition as powerful as when I have witnessed persons in other transitions, such as newborns, newlyweds, recent converts, and people making major decisions. Could it be that death has something in common with these other transitions? Could it be that just as hard as it is to leave the womb behind or go from being a student to the responsibilities of being a worker, we outgrow the comfort zone of life itself and must allow ourselves to dwell in the wider expanse we label death, for want of a better word. Perhaps those of us left behind really will be joining our missed loved ones in this more flexible arena. In the meantime, the next emotional and spiritual stage of life commences for the survivors. An apt name indeed for grievers.